Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Supreme Court licenses deputizing private vigilantes to control women's bodies. The gutting of Roe v. Wade. We speak with Chelsea Wiggins now, counsel with the National Abortion Federation, which works to unite, represent, serve, and support abortion providers in delivering patient-centered, evidence-based care. Thank you for joining us.
There was a time when abortion was not very clear political lines, wedge issue that really got the right out to the polls in the way that it is used today. That's developed over the years. Folks will talk about Schlafly and pushes to make abortion this wedge issue over the last several decades. But I guess even just the last 10 years, you can look to the emergence of TRAP laws, targeted regulation of abortion providers, and see that it has become this perpetual drumbeat, chipping away and attacking this right, using it as a tool, cutting off abortion access and all of the harms that that brings for real people in the world, using them and their bodies as a political pawn to drive certain parties to power. And that is just so hard to see and also frustrating to think that, gosh, you know, 50 years ago, that environment was really quite different, and yet here we are in this moment where abortion rights are so threatened and attacked.
Even during that period, certainly there were the political operatives who weaponized the issue of women's control over their bodies. But was there ever really a majority of the population that was registered as antagonistic to abortion, certainly in these last, let's say, 20 years?
We are at a place now where polling has indicated again and again a majority of people support Roe, support abortion access. My general understanding is that that's not a recent or major change, but I cannot pretend to be an expert on how that has shifted over the decades. I can say with confidence for sure that now, even though we are seeing legislatures passing these incredibly draconian laws, that doesn't reflect the viewpoint of the American populace on this issue.
You indicated there was a tracking system, tracking the harassment before the advent of the Texas law. Help us understand some of the nature of the harassment and the chipping away in these last years that culminated in the tech legislation.
We track violence and disruption statistics. On an annual basis, we publish a collection of what we have heard from our members about the harassment and incidents of violence that they and their patients have experienced. Anti-abortion extremists devote an awful lot of time and energy to harassing and sometimes seeking even to physically harm abortion providers, the staff that works at clinic, the patients who are just trying to enter and exit a clinic and get their care. Every single day, protesters outside screaming awful things at patients, physically obstructing their ability to enter clinics. In some cases, we have had situations where the same people show up every day for decades on end, and they will follow providers home. They will follow their children to school. I mean, it's really scary. And that's not even speaking to the incidents of violence, right, where someone's threats, it's impossible to know one day where somebody's threat is going to escalate to violence. One of the things that we have seen over the years, at times when abortion is particularly targeted in a way that has risen to the national consciousness, right, as we're seeing right now with SB 8 in Texas, that tends to be tied to an uptick in threats of violence at clinics all across the country. So unfortunately, we are in one of those moments where the harassment and threats of violence that providers and patients face every day are particularly at high levels right now. And, you know, we also see this. Abortion has been increasingly used as sort of a political tool. When you are making people who could provide this health care afraid to provide that care, you are chipping away at the pool of people who might be able to provide abortion care. And when you are making patients who need this care afraid to go to clinics, so they avoid them, you are chipping away at the ability of patients who need care to get to that care. for the last 50 years, we've got this line of cases very clearly stating that the right to access abortion is constitutionally protected, and yet we have seen hostile motivated state legislatures passing all of these laws for many years under the guise of protecting a patient's health. These laws that just make it harder and harder for clinics to stay open and for providers to provide abortion care, you find yourself in a situation, as we see today, where access, even in states, right, putting aside the question of extreme, terrifying laws like SB 8 in Texas, there are many states where abortion access is incredibly, incredibly difficult to come by for many patients because of these trap laws that have been enacted and allowed to stand. Practically speaking, it is very difficult for lots of patients, especially the most vulnerable patients, to be able to get the care they need.
Help us understand why or how Texas became ground zero for what is right now the most devastating legal blow to women's access to abortion.
States in general tend to function as a proving ground for abortion restrictions. You know, we've seen that time and time again. Many states will introduce almost sort of carbon copies of the same exact bill language with some new abortion restriction that folks trying to cut off access to that care have come up with. It's sort of a throwing spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks kind of approach. And if it sticks in enough places, then we tend to see it introduced at the federal level. Obviously, we aren't there with SB 8 right now, but this enforcement mechanism of SB 8 is part of what makes it so challenging to deal with. It's enforced by civil suits rather than by the government, as is normal for an abortion restriction, and that has made it more challenging to file a lawsuit against. Texas is the first state enacting a law like this, but we've actually seen that enforcement mechanism appear earlier this year in a city ordinance or two. So I think even just sort of on a micro level, in this case, we are watching the first little seedling. I don't know what it is about Texas, to be honest with you, but they do seem to tend to strike when the iron is hot and get themselves out at the fore. I don't think they'll be the last or only state to pass or attempt to pass this kind of legislation, but yet again, they do seem to have been the ones to be a bellwether of some sort.
Parse out for us some of the most restrictive, punitive components that are part of the law that was passed in Texas. One of the most terrifying aspects of it is that it has legitimized and actually sought to mobilize a form of vigilante justice.
What the law does, it bans abortion after cardiac activity is detectable. That piece of it is not all that abnormal in terms of unconstitutional bills being introduced and passed in state legislatures hostile to abortion. So one of the things that's frustrating about this, right, is that the language even that is used by anti-abortion folks is misleading and inaccurate. You know, they'll talk about a fetal heartbeat. Well, when cardiac activity is detectable, that happens around 6 weeks, although it can be a little earlier. So it tends to get shorthanded as a six-week ban. But at that stage, it's not a fetus. It's still an embryo. It doesn't have a heart yet. There can't be a heartbeat, right? There are lots of scientific medical inaccuracies. That alone cuts off access for so many people. I mean, if you're being conservative, you're talking about 10 to 15% of people will be able to get an abortion of all the people who need one when you ban abortion at about 6 weeks. That alone is obviously draconian and awful and has a terrible impact on the patients who need care and specifically, as ever, falls hardest on the people who are the most vulnerable, on low-income folks, BIPOC folks, on young people, right, on the people who won't be able to take the time off work and get the child care to get themselves out of the very large state of Texas to get care somewhere else. What is unique about SB 8 and what has been so difficult and scary for folks is that it also prohibits aiding or abetting someone in getting an abortion in violation of the law or intending to aid and abet. It's unclear how far those tentacles reach. We've seen a lot of folks talking about the different examples of somebody who could be vulnerable under that suit, especially because another scary component of this law is that it is enforced civilly rather than by the Texas state government, sort of deputizes anybody anywhere to file a lawsuit against someone who they suspect of aiding or abetting, intending to aid or abet, providing or intending to provide an abortion in violation of the law. It's not limited to people with, you know, any sort of tie to a specific abortion. It's not limited to people who live in Texas. It could be anybody who decides they want to use this excuse to go after people involved in providing and helping patients get access to abortion care. Now, people can't sue the patient, but they can sue an awful lot of people who are quite tangentially related. And so that's a major component of this law that is punitive and very scary. There are lots of norms of the American legal system that are subverted in this law. So one of the deterrents to filing a frivolous lawsuit is that if you do and you lose, you have to pay attorney's fees for the other side. This law makes it so if an abortion provider loses, the provider will have to pay the attorney's fees for the anti that sued them. But if the reverse happens and the anti loses, they don't have to pay the attorney's fees for the other side. So one of those deterrents to people filing is not there. Another thing is that typically the way the American legal system works, when you have an injunction against a given law, when you have a bar put in place that stops a law from being enforced, which is often what happens in abortion litigation, generally speaking, it is important for people to be able to rely on that. If we could not rely on an injunction to protect us, it would be impossible to know whether or not we could continue exercising a given constitutional right, in this case, abortion. What SB 8 has tried to do is to take that norm of American jurisprudence away by saying if an injunction gets put in place, but then at a later stage of litigation gets removed, anything that violates SB 8 that took place during the injunction is fair game for a lawsuit. Everything is so murky with this law. It's so unpredictable. It puts providers and patients and somebody's grandmother who drives them to their clinic, all in this tenuous situation where even if the law is barred from enforcement with an injunction, it's still not clear a few years down the line, somebody's not going to come after you with a lawsuit. The last thing is there's no cap on the damages. Now, I've seen a lot of places talking about how it's a $10,000 bounty for vigilantes on anybody who provides abortion or helps somebody get abortion in any way. And actually, it's a minimum $10,000 bounty if you win. It has no limitation whatsoever. So theoretically, somebody could sue for $1 million is scary. I mean, this law is so cruelly drafted, just puts people in a really tenuous, unpredictable situation.
What do we absolutely think will happen on the ground to women in Texas who are seeking abortions, aside from the six-week prohibition, from this vigilante license, the practicality? What happens to them? You've already indicated, of course, that it is most likely to happen to poor women, and most decidedly.
NAF has a hotline, the toll-free multilingual hotline for abortion information and financial assistance. We have been hearing already from our counselors on our hotline, patients are terrified and really feel lost and unsure of what to do. A small fraction of the patients who need abortion care in Texas will be able to get it before 6 weeks. About maybe 15% of them will be able to get their care. The rest of them will either need to find a way to get themselves out of the state for care. Some patients are able to do on their own. You know, NAFT hotline is able in some cases to assist patients travel out of state. The local abortion funds are able to assist the patients travel out of state and get their care. That is not a reality for lots of people. So for those people, some of them we are already hearing will stay pregnant or seek other ways to get the abortion care that they need. And another thing, we've got a huge population of people in Texas. There are lots of people who are not going to be able to get the care they need, including undocumented patients who won't be able to leave the state. Even if they had all the money in the world, even if they had all the time in the world and could get out of state, they may not be able to get past the checkpoint crossing a border into another state and will not be able to get to care, even if all the resources in the world are available for them. And then there are also people, like a patient who we heard from who had an ectopic pregnancy, which is not a viable pregnancy and is a life-threatening condition. We are 2 weeks into this law. The OB was afraid to give that patient a referral for the abortion care that she needed because of SB8. They said, we have to talk to our lawyers. And a week later, she was still experiencing an ectopic pregnancy and had nothing to go on. And so she called our hotline, and we were able to encourage her to find care and help her through that process. There you're looking at somebody who absolutely has a medical emergency and needs that abortion care as permitted by the law, but this law has such a chilling effect. I think we're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see people who are even sort of tangentially connected to this law, afraid of what their own liability could be because it's all so unknown, because it's all so absurd. I think we will see a ripple effect in their ability to access care. Our members in Texas are working so hard to get everybody who possibly can be seen under this heinous law seen in Texas. We also have members outside of Texas who have worked so hard, so valiantly to make themselves as available as possible for the patients who are moving out of state. We are seeing now this ripple effect for the states that border Texas, states that have direct flights out of Texas, seeing an increase in Texas patients that also impact the patients who live in that state and are trying to get care. If you're in California, you are seeing an uptick in patients coming from Texas. That's going to impact the appointment availability for the patients in California, too.
The Department of Justice just filed suit. Tell us about the essence of the litigation there, what it is essentially contesting, and your own assessment as an attorney as to the viability, the challenge.
It was incredibly heartening to see the DOJ file their suit. That was incredibly heartening to see. It was sort of the second heartening moment as far as litigation goes. In my opinion, you know, in mid-July, several abortion providers, many of whom are NAS members, in addition to some funds and some individual folks, filed a lawsuit in federal court against SB8. In both cases, right, in both situations, the suit, the provider and fund suit from July and now here in the DOJ case. I think they were both very strong arguments. I am genuinely hopeful that we will see good results and reasoned decisions. In both situations, right, the primary point is that the law is unconstitutional under Roe and 50 years of subsequent case law. You're talking about the DOJ's case. We're also having a conversation about the supremacy of federal law and also touch on the obligations of the federal government in providing certain services as pertains to abortion, right? We have things like the Hyde Amendment that incredibly severely curtail Medicaid coverage, for example, for abortion care. But there are certain carve-outs at the federal level, for example, for cases of rape or incest. The federal government is obligated to adhere to certain requirements around abortion that are not allowed for under SB8, right? SB8 contains no rape or incest exception. And so that's a part of the argument, too. But really, the heart of it is that this law is unconstitutional under Roe and 50 years of case law. There is no looking at an approximately 6-week ban and saying, I'm not sure whether that's a ban after viability or not. It's very clear. It's an open and shut case.
It's going to wind its way back to the Supreme Court, who deliberately punted giving license to the Texas legislature to enact this bill. We'll see how that unfolds. But what I also interested in your thoughts on the Women's Health Protection Act, which is to really codify federally the right to abortion. Your thoughts on the viability of the passage of that? Or is this politically, symbolically, it's a wonderful piece of legislation, but does it have any legs?
We are certainly in a moment where the realities of our two chambers in Congress are such that. But the reality is it is a challenging environment in this moment with the current makeup that we have and the barriers in place to passing progressive legislation. It is a challenging time to say that we can pass this bill easily right now. But the nature of progressive legislation often is that it is many years of work and moving by step towards a positive future, getting the law passed and really having an improvement. We are at a point with this bill where Speaker Pelosi has said, going to bring this up when they're back in session. We are seeing positive steps. You know, the bill has gotten a hearing. We are seeing movement. And I think that this could be a positive galvanizing flashpoint for this bill to help surge it forward. It would be much better had something like SB 8 not been the reason that folks felt really energized about abortion in this moment. Here we are, nonetheless, and people are feeling galvanized and energized to do something and recognizing that we really need to act in a big and meaningful way. So I am hopeful that we already have this vehicle in the Women's Health Protection Act for protecting the right to access abortion care all across the country in a significant manner. We already have it. There's already groundwork that has been laid for many years by lots of hardworking advocates to get this bill to where it already is. I am hopeful that folks will be able to seize this opportunity, move it forward in a meaningful way such that it could be a path to increasing access. The Women's Health Protection Act is really quite broad protection against the kinds of laws we have been seeing for years and years that are chipping away at access. And so it would really be a meaningful difference for patients in lots of states, not just Texas, who have seen access dwindle and dwindle and diminish over the last several years.
Chelsea Wiggins, for the work you do, we particularly want to thank you and just ask you if you can give us a preview of the work that you do as we continue to finally solidify politically and legally, legislatively, women's right to family plan, access to health, to control over their bodies, the essential fight and the essence of any state that portends to be democratic. Tell us about your own work so that people can keep in touch with and continue to support your organization.
The National Abortion Federation is a membership organization for abortion providers. Our mission is to unite, represent, and serve and support abortion providers in delivering patient-centered, evidence-based care. We also have a toll-free hotline for information about abortion and for financial assistance in the U.S. and Canada. We provide callers with accurate information, confidential consultation, options counseling, and information about providers of quality abortion care. Our website is www.prochoice.org, and there you can find information about the kind of work we do. Also, we have a find a provider function that can help patients locate providers in their area. Folks looking for care anywhere in the U.S. can turn to that resource or to our hotline to get information and to find out whether they could be eligible for financial assistance in accessing care. You know, in the last few weeks, our providers in Texas and out of Texas, but especially in Texas in this awful moment, have worked so hard. They were working up till 11:59 p.m. on August 31st, providing as much care as they possibly could to try to help folks. They have worked so hard to provide care that complies with this law to as many people as they can. We just have so much love for them in our hearts. And similarly, you know, on our hotline, our counselors have just been working so diligently to help these patients who are calling us in moments of fear and confusion. Whenever a law like this passes, one of the things that always happens on our hotline is that patients all over the country, not just in the state where the law has passed, call and say, can I even get an abortion in my state? These laws do so much to create confusion and fear and difficulties for patients everywhere. So NAF works really hard to help support the providers who are fighting the good fight and providing care all across the country and to help the patients who need help getting care to get to that abortion. As I said, we are an organization that supports abortion, we're a membership organization for providers, so folks, of course, can donate to NAF to support the work that we do both on our hotline to help patients get to care and also in support of the abortion providers who fight tooth and nail and just work themselves to the bone in incredibly hostile and, as we discussed, often threatening environments to make sure that patients can get to the care that they need. There are people in every single state doing the work and fighting the fight, and I would encourage folks to look to them, to lend their support to them.
We've been speaking with Chelsea Wiggins with the National Abortion Federation, which works to unite, represent, serve, and support abortion providers in delivering patient-centered, evidence-based care. Thank you for the work that you do. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.